summers are always rough in Washington.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm going to do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime.
Healthcare reform cannot wait.
We are facing the greatest economic challenge of our lifetime.
It must not wait.
Combating climate change.
Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it will not wait another year.
Yikes, Obama has a few things left to do this summer. Big stuff. We always have big plans for the summer, but I hate it when you can't get to everything.
Ain't no cure for the summertime.
Obama's summertime blues. Is there a cure? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good summertime blues Labor Day morning. It's Monday, September 7th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this morning, the U.S. Open. A ton of upsets. We'll talk about them with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Also, public schools are asking parents to supply cash to keep some of their programs going. And we get a preview of the fall TV season, what you must see and what you can miss. Yes, there is a fall rollout. But first, let's check in with Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, watching the healthcare debate. So, professor, if healthcare didn't get passed this summer, is that just regular old summertime blues in Washington, or a sign that there's real difficulty in Congress dealing with something big like this?
Congress always has a long process to deal with something as big as this, but let's keep this in perspective. Three committees in the House and one in the Senate have already reported out bills on health care. This thing is moving along at a pretty good clip, even if President Obama did hope that all of the committees would finish before the August break. The question is, what happens now?
Well, there may be a cure for the summertime blues, according to Theda Scotchpole. Stay with us. All the details in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. Just getting news in from the Associated Press that a Sudanese judge has fined a female journalist $200 for wearing trousers, but didn't punish her. They didn't punish her by flogging. In the headlines, a Swedish charity is accusing American troops of storming through a hospital in central Afghanistan in search for militants. Charity spokesman Anders Fanga.
When they left, they told the staff that if any suspected Taliban or insurgent would come for treatment to the hospital staff should inform the American troops about this.
The spokesman also said that the soldiers broke down doors and tied up hospital staff. The Pentagon says it's investigating. Meanwhile, our partner, the New York Times, has more details on reports of fraud in Afghanistan's election from last month. They spoke with Western diplomats there who say that about 15% of the polling sites never opened, but still recorded hundreds of thousands of votes for President Hamid Karzai. Here in the U.S., more than half of a deadly wildfire near Los Angeles has been contained. The blaze could still harm thousands of other homes in the region, though none are in immediate danger. Full containment isn't expected until next week. In Northern California, transit workers are scrambling to repair a crack in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. They discovered it over the weekend while they were replacing another part of the bridge. And in Asia today, all major financial indices were up more than 1%. Wall Street, of course, has the day off for the Labor Day holiday. It's the unofficial end of summer. Labor Day always has a twinge of regret with it. There's probably still a lot on your plate that you wanted to get done. I wanted to do some kayaking, but I didn't. We know Obama wanted to pass health care, but didn't. What did you miss out on doing this summer? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Somebody last week said they didn't finish their dissertation.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Labor Day. People are getting ready, not for work, but sort of the last day of the summer. We've already gotten some responses on what are your regrets, things you didn't get done this summer. Why health care reform is not going smoothly, says Rob Garcia. He tweets us. Opposing Republicans, no. Democrats aren't buying it, he says. Johnny in Michigan emails us. I'm not doing much to mark the end of summer. I was supposed to start classes at the local university, but the professors are on strike and classes are canceled indefinitely. Well, there's a big to-do list left in Washington. We want to know what you have regrets about not doing this summer. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And health care is one of the regrets, although it didn't sound like it when David Axelrod spoke on Meet the Press yesterday, talking about Obama's health care address that he's going to deliver on Wednesday before a joint session of Congress.
The president set forth principles at the beginning of this discussion, at the beginning of the year, and now all the ideas are on the table, and the president will say, we agree on 80% of this. Let's do the final 20%. Let's get the job done, and here's how I think we should do it.
It's David Axelrod, White House senior political advisor on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. Theda Skocpol rejoins us now, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, author of Boomerang, Health Reform and the Turn Against Government. And Julie Mason is also with us, White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Julie and Theda, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Nice to be here.
So, Theda, you say there's some momentum here, and I guess Barack Obama has a chance to increase the pace of that momentum on Wednesday. What does he have to get specific about, Professor Skocpol?
He needs to be clear with Congress and the public about what the three or four core elements of a doable and significant health reform are at this point. He needs to put down his markers about where he'd like to see the different congressional committees come together and bridge the differences between the House and the Senate in particular.
Julie Mason, what are White House officials saying about what the president is going to do? I was listening very carefully all weekend long, and it seems as though the public option is definitely going to be discussed, but there's clearly going to be some deliberate wiggle room on Wednesday. I don't know if that's what you're hearing.
For sure.
Really? The
public option is definitely on the block. But, I mean, to listen to the White House officials talk about it, they would tell you that Obama's been an incredibly effective steward of this issue all along. But, you know, that's definitely not been the case. As late as Saturday, he still didn't know what he wanted to say about health care. And this late in the process, for him to not know what he wanted to say about health care, that's a very bad sign.
Well, let's talk specifically and sort of structurally about what this means. Theda Skocpol said at the top of the hour that actually there is some momentum. Three committees have actually dealt with this. The president's going to give a major speech, and you know, getting something as comprehensive as this done in the summer is a low percentage shot anyway. But here's Lamar Alexander talking on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace about his assessment of whether the Congress is any good at this sort of big bill kind of thing.
Let's start over and let's focus on cost. Cost to you when you buy your health insurance, cost to the American people for their government.
Basically, Lamar Alexander said, we don't do comprehensive very well. We're seeing it with health care. These 1,000-page bills that try to change complex systems simply don't work. Do you agree with that, Theda?
No, I don't at all. And, frankly, Lamar Alexander is speaking for a party that doesn't want this to work for political reasons. It's, of course, complex. And for reform to work in a case like our health insurance system, several things have to change at once. There has to be some money to pay for the uninsured. There have to be new rules to protect people who already have insurance. And there has to be some decision about how you're going to build more competition and cost control into the system as a whole. We don't know whether it's all going to come together, but it's much closer now than it has been in 100 years. And so it's not rhetoric to say that we're very close. We may not get the final steps, but there's a lot of push behind this. And the Democrats, as in general, even though they disagree on some of the last 20%, they know that if they fail to pass any bill, they're committing political suicide.
I mean, the pressure is really on the Democrats because they have both houses of Congress and the White House. Julie Mason, I heard reports all weekend long that the White House is unilaterally lobbying Olympia Snow, Republican of Maine, to get a moderate on board to basically up the political momentum here. There still appears to be some contact with Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, who was part of the Gang of Six. I don't even know where the Gang of Six stands at this point. What do you know?
Well, the Gang of Six have sort of lost their effectiveness over the month of August. Problem for Obama is, well, Congress is part of it, but also he's lost public support for this. The more he's talked about health care, the worse the numbers have gotten. So he has to sell not just to Congress, but he has to convince people, too, because Congress isn't going to do something that the people don't want. So that's going to be a tough sell for Obama on Wednesday as well.
Well, let's get an assessment from both of you. Julie, I'll begin with you. Does he have to convince people of something they don't want to do, or simply get rid of the fear that's been just sort of hosed through the system because of this unfortunate town meeting episode that we witnessed all summer long? Julie, you first, and then Theda Skocpol.
Right, that was tough. I think he has to show a little bit of passion on this issue. He's been dry and a bit professorial. He's got to tell people why they need this. He's got to remind them. He's got to show some fortitude. Like I said, some passion.
Theda Skocpol, is it about uphill battle convincing, or is it about dispelling fear that's really come into the picture over the summer?
Largely the latter. The president does have to show some passion. He also has to probably give some real-life instances of people, insured and not insured, who will benefit in specific ways from the reforms that are coming together. Let's not overplay the downside here. Most Americans still trust Barack Obama and the Democratic Party more than they trust Republicans on this issue. And people will be paying attention in new ways. A lot of what happened in August was really not engaging most Americans beyond the vociferous opponents of the president. He has a new opportunity here. I don't know whether he'll succeed, and he has to do better than he did before the break, but he's got a real chance.
Is the argument, Professor Scotchpole, that the president has to say why what we do on Medicare will work for the millions of people who are uninsured if he wants a public option? Or does he then, if he backs away from the public option, does he have to explain why he doesn't think what is working for Medicare will work for the uninsured?
Well, the Democrats have been mysteriously unwilling to draw an analogy between the public option and Medicare. I don't understand that myself. But I don't think Barack Obama has to come out and say, I want the public option no matter what. What he has to do is explain why a public option might make a difference for the better for millions of Americans all across the United States. He hasn't done that yet, so he hasn't failed at it. He hasn't done it.
Julie, I'm a little unsure as to what's in the 80% and what's in the 20% that Axelrod is obsessed with here. Obama apparently still is on board with the principle of pre-existing conditions don't deny you insurance under this new reform package. Is that in the 80% or the 20%? And it's expected he will talk about that on Wednesday.
Right, he will. But there's real pushback from the industry on that. They don't want to go along with that. So and if he has to put that on the table to get health care done, that's the thing. They haven't really been clear on what is non-negotiable. You know, it seems with the Obama administration, everything is sort of negotiable. And they've put forth some notions, some principles, but nothing hard and true.
But clear on a takeaway here, you don't necessarily believe that the pre-existing condition principle is in the 80%. That might be in the 20%.
That might be in the 20%.
Yeah, Theda, you think 80%? It's in the 80%?
No, I mean, let's be clear here. This isn't a negotiation about whether we're going to have new rules for the insurance industry. That is in all the bills that have come forward so far. Even Republicans aren't going to question that. That's there.
All right. So that's in the 80%. Julie says maybe not in the 80%. This is good stuff, though. This is helpful for me. And if it's helpful for me, you know, what about the mandate? Is the mandate a principle that is in the 20% or in the 80%? Are we agreed on that? Julie, you first and then Professor
Scott.
Well,
what exactly do you mean by the mandate?
Well, the idea that you have to get insurance. You have to go out and buy insurance.
Yeah, I think that's probably in the 80%.
That's in the 80%. Would you agree with that, Professor Scotchpole?
You know, I have a slightly different take on that one. I think that, first of all, there are two mandates. One is, do all businesses have to insure employees or contribute to the process with some money? That's one question, the business mandate. That's in the 20%.
Interesting.
The individual mandate is probably on the cusp, because I suspect in the end that the Democrats won't agree to some of these changes if forcing people to buy insurance if the insurance isn't affordable and subsidized for millions of Americans.
On some level, in the broadest sense, just a few seconds, so Julie Mason and Theda Scotchpole, the president really has to take his personal popularity and turn that into a trust in government on something this big on Wednesday. Correct? Julie, you first.
True, John, but it's not what it used to be. I mean, over this summer, we've seen Gallup. He's down to 50%.
Theda Scotchpole?
Yeah, he's back up to 55. And, you know, we really, in the business we're in here, including many professors, we pay way too much attention to these short-term fluctuations.
All right. Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, author of Boomerang, Health Reform and the Turn Against Government, and Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Your takeaways on what's in the 80% and what's in the 20% on health care. Coming up. Why this plucky show choir is the talk of the TV season. That's coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. The revolution in television actually is going to be televised. Remember when there was an actual fall season, a big, huge, giant rollout of network shows? Well, nowadays, shows are rolled out sort of one at a time, and it's very, very difficult to even know what's coming. There's actually a new season that starts in January. But such as it is, beleaguered networks are offering some new entertainment, and here to detect if there is actually any entertainment value in what the networks are offering this fall, and it actually sort of starts this week, is Kim Potts, founder of TVScreener.com, our buddy. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, just a quick question. We're asking everybody on the show this morning, is there anything you didn't get done this summer that you really wanted to do? I wanted to get in a kayak. Didn't happen. Anything?
I wanted to do a road trip, and it just didn't. The summer got away from me.
Yeah. Don't you hate that?
Yes.
Give us your regrets this summer. 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. So what are the networks have for us this fall, given that they're complaining about not being able to sell enough ad revenue and they're delaying their fall seasons later and later into the year?
It's true. In fact, January, kind of the big things are happening in January, the last season of Lost, maybe the last season of 24, American Idol without Paula. So those are the kind of big things are put off. But there are some good things. Comedy is kind of the thing this year instead of the dramas that they've been focusing on the last few seasons. Remakes, a couple of big shows like Glee, which everybody has heard about and is pretty excited about.
Let's talk about Glee in a second. NBC is obsessed with comedy. There's nothing to laugh about on their bottom line, of course, and they're doing Leno at 10, so that their primetime schedule is going to be dominated by, you know, rolling out of Leno. But give me an assessment of this program called Community.
What is community college? You've heard it's loser college for remedial teens, 20-something dropouts, middle-aged divorcees, and old people keeping their minds active as they circle the drain of eternity. However, I wish you luck! Okay, there's more to this speech. There's actually a middle card that is missing. Can we all look around our immediate areas?
Now, this sounds really appealing, kind of an uplifting sort of like there's all is well in the world sort of comedy.
It's funny.
Really?
The main star, it is. It actually is one of the two.
Set in a community college.
It is. I know. Not exactly what you would think would lead to humor. But it stars the host of The Soup on E!, which it's a very culty kind of thing, so maybe a lot of people don't know him yet, but Joel McHale. It is very funny. It does have kind of an underlying sweet message. It's very sarcastic. It fits in with the 30 Rock and The Office and those shows. But
it may just capture the audience of millions of unemployed Americans going back to community colleges trying to get retrained for jobs.
That's true. That's an interesting take on it.
All right. Well, they will certainly hope that those numbers come in. Here's Fox's offering Glee.
High school is a caste system. Kids fall into certain slots. Your jocks and your popular kids up in the penthouse. The Invisibles and the kids playing live action druids and trolls out in the forest, bottom floor.
And where do the Glee kids lie?
Sub-basement.
Another deconstruction of high school, it seems, from Fox. But they're betting a lot on this show. How can you tell?
How can you not tell, really, right? It's everywhere. They've taken to Twitter. They've gone everywhere trying to promote it, and they've been promoting it all summer.
The cast is actually tweeting.
The cast is tweeting. They did a mall tour, kind of throwback to 90210 and when those shows kind of launched on the WB and Fox. And Dawson's Creek on WB. They put a lot into it. They showed the first episode right after American Idol last spring and then kind of forgot about it all summer in terms of putting it back on. But marketing-wise, they haven't forgotten about it at all. And people are pretty excited about it.
And two words on Melrose Place, back on the CW instead of – it was originally Fox, right?
Right, yeah. It was kind of the companion – or was a spinoff of 90210. They're very wisely bringing back a couple of the old characters.
Nostalgia of the last, like, 3 years.
Exactly.
Exactly. There we go.
Yeah.
Kim Potts, founder of TVScreener.com. You still have time for that road trip, I figure, right? Good luck with that.
Maybe, yeah.
Thanks so much. Here now in the studio, of course, that means it can only be Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, who did everything he wanted to do this summer. Takeaway sports contributor. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Any regrets this summer?
I did not get my full workout regimen in gear.
And you are so buff. You look like you could just sort of bend all the microphones in this studio. Absolutely. So if people could see you, go to our website for signs that Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen does not need to work out. All right. The U.S. Open, full of upsets. Let's run them down, first of all.
Well, first of all, the Americans. There's Udan, Udan, Melanie Udan.
Incredible. Beat Sharapova in three sets.
She is the face of the new face of American tennis. But at the same time, Andy Roddick goes down, and now we're wondering, is he done in tennis altogether?
I mean, I got to figure that Federer match at Wimbledon really killed him.
We were just saying it spiritually depleted him.
Yeah.
But I think that you have to remember the U.S. Open is at the end of an entire long season, so a lot of the players, Nadal, Venus, who went down yesterday.
Explain that, because there's a story there. Venus Williams goes down to Kim Clijsters, who's coming back from retirement.
And she came back from having a child. She comes back from retirement. The last time she played in the U.S. Open was 2005, and she won. So she is a legitimate chance to, I mean, she's a favorite right now. And if she goes against Serena, she's kind of got the Williams number. So I think she's one to watch.
So a lot of excitement in the women's game.
Definitely.
Clijsters and Udan, both the real emotional favorites.
Certainly, yeah. And in the men's game, I think it's a little bit different. You have Murray and Andy Murray, and you have Roger Federer, and then you have Rafael Nadal that are playing excellent tennis.
Right. Any sign that Nadal's knees are looking a little tricky?
His knees and his abdominal. He's got a stomach problem as well.
Man.
He's beat up right now.
He's beat up, yeah. All right, here, listen to Melanie Udan. You say she's the face of women's tennis. Let's just listen to how appealing she sounds.
I mean, I just kept fighting as hard as I could, and I tried as hard as I could, and ended up winning, and I just can't even believe it.
Very Cinderella sounding there. Who does she go up against now?
Well, right now, I think she goes up against Nadia Petrova, who's the 13th ranked in the world, and that's going to be a difficult challenge. But this is the thing: they're putting her in prime time tennis right now. She gets the main draw, the big. All the crowds are going to be watching her, and she is the face of this not only a new tennis, but this new wave and this new energy of like people creating themselves. The women's field has been so depleted that you're going to see new heroes come out of it.
All right, finally, college game, college football.
It is amazing this
big
week.
Big headline?
Yes.
Quickly.
Well, we had Sam Bradford, who was the former the Heisman champion from last year, who led the most explosive offense last year, goes down.
Shoulder injury?
Correct.
But they only expect it to take two or three weeks to rehab.
It takes the air out of their sails of winning in the national championship, and it completely changed the landscape of college football this year.
And Oklahoma is always in the hunt for that national championship. Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. And coming up on the program, what's on the agenda for the week ahead, non-sports-wise, and what will be making news in your world? Marcus Mabry joins us with Jill McGivering of our partner, the BBC, in just a minute.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Let's begin with some of the headlines we're following this morning with Femi Okay.
And the time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. In Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai received hundreds of thousands of false votes in the election last month. Our partner, The New York Times, reports that the ballots were recorded from fake polling places where nobody actually voted. Israel has approved construction of hundreds of new apartments in the West Bank. Palestinians say that they won't resume peace talks until all settlement construction stops. Venezuela has agreed to send Iran 20,000 barrels of gasoline a day.
Why does Iran need gasoline?
The shipments will begin in October. Obviously, they are a little short at the moment.
Yes.
And finally, the Space Shuttle Discovery is scheduled to undock from the International Space Station tomorrow. Today, astronauts are loading a moving container that will offload completed science experiments, surplus equipment, and a lot of trash. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on?
So this Labor Day Monday morning, the agenda certainly is going to include health care, and we've already talked about that extensively earlier on in the program. So we thought we'd begin with the issues besides health care that are going to dominate the administration when it gets back to work tomorrow in Washington. Joining us, of course, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning, John.
And from our partner, the BBC, Jill McGivering joins us from London. She's the Asia editor for the BBC. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So, Marcus, let me begin with you. This whole issue that dusted up over the weekend that relates to the president speaking to a high school in Virginia, giving an intimate speech on educational issues to U.S. school children that has become this huge issue for conservative pundits and talk radio people, and the administration seems to have stepped in it. And then there's the issue of Van Jones, the green jobs consultant on the Council of Economic or Environmental Quality, who had to resign because of what he calls a smear campaign. It seems to me the administration is on the defensive because of some pretty silly media dust storms. What's your assessment, Marcus?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. One of the things to watch this week, John, of course, it is the week of the speech. You know, whether it's, as you mentioned, the healthcare speech he's going to give to Congress or the speech he'll be giving to these high schoolers in Virginia that originally was going to be played through the White House's website to high schools around the country. It seems we've moved in our country from kind of partisanship, which is something we've known for a long time, certainly most of George W. Bush's administration, to paranoia. And that kind of paranoia, kind of partisan paranoia, I think has really affected the White House, not just in serious policies like health care reform and what it can get, and a very important issue, makes up a huge part of our economy, but even, as you said, in these smaller issues that are at this point are affecting even, you know, personnel choices. It's going to be interesting to see how the White House bounces back this week, whether it remains on defensive and actually keeps responding to this stuff, because actually it makes the president look weaker, whether they actually can take some control of the agenda and make it somewhat irrational and reasonable.
I think you're right, Marcus. And listen to David Axelrod here, Obama's senior political advisor on Meet the Press yesterday. Do you detect in this tone a sense of grasping the message and taking control or defensiveness?
I was a little bewildered by it because I think it's an important and wholesome message. There's nothing political about it, and it's a shame that some people have tried to politicize it.
That's David Axelrod referring to the speech before school children in Virginia that will be broadcast nationwide.
Well, I think there's certainly defensiveness there, but I think the White House also plans to release it today, so maybe there'll be more schools that actually will pick it up. But again, it's a disheartening reality of kind of the times we live in right now, you know.
Right. A year ago, the government took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, marking the beginning of the sort of bailout meltdown financial difficulties that really began when people came back from Labor Day vacations and suddenly cashed out of their stock portfolios and moved into cash and other vehicles. What are Wall Street investors and the Obama administration worried about going forward this week?
Well, you know, it's going to be we've been going through this on the one hand, on the other hand, market. So on the one hand, you have job losses slowing last week as reported with the August job loss numbers. But on the other hand, you have us reaching 9.7% unemployment, which could at this point even go above the 10% mark that many economists have seen before, even if we have seen the worst of the recession. So this is a problem. On the one hand, you have good news. On the other hand, you always have this kind of contradictory negative news. So even though we've reached the bottom of the recession, it seems, at the same time, it's not clear whether consumers can actually sustain and keep spending for this recession. So on the other hand, market, you now have this dismal, dark anniversary that really shook New York to its core. If we remember what happened a year ago with the failure of Lehman Brothers and the bailouts of Fannie and Freddie, it rocked Wall Street in a way that we'd never seen in any of our lifetimes. So it's a really scary place to be. It's kind of like being on slippery rocks this week. So it's going to be interesting to see what the market does. And the middle is on the one hand, on the other hand, time we're in, as it remembers this really dark anniversary.
Right.
Now, on the one hand, one might decide, we've come out of it really relatively unscathed, given the magnitude and the ampler of what happened last year. So maybe the market will feel relieved.
Well, optimistic caution or cautious optimism, I guess that's probably the rule of the day. Jill McGivering joining us from London. Talk about rocking the current reality. Stanley McChrystal in this remark yesterday, part of his report on what's going on in Afghanistan, has certainly changed the game in thinking about the Afghanistan war. Listen to this.
I think this effort is all about protecting Afghans from all kinds of harm, and so we've got to make every effort to do that.
But the effort does not seem to be working, and there seems to be a review going on in the Pentagon right now, and even more reports from the New York Times this morning that corruption in the Afghan election is going to make it unlikely that a runoff can be scheduled anytime soon. What's the state of what's going on in Afghanistan, Jill?
Well, we've got quite a mixed picture at the moment. You're right in terms of the election. There are these growing reports, very widespread reports, about polling stations where there seems to have been all sorts of malpractice, ballot stuffing and so on, ballot rigging. And that is raising some very serious concerns about how legitimate this process will be and how credible any result is going to be. I put that in the context in which many Afghans would before these elections have said, we're very sceptical about politicians, we don't really trust them, we think there's a lot of corruption in this system. And we don't think that they serve our interests. We don't think that they're accountable. That's certainly the views that I heard reflected to me when I was last in Helmand province last year. So you take that very sceptical environment and then you take an election which seems to be, at the moment, the way things are looking, pretty flawed. It doesn't add up to a very positive, strong view on democracy emerging.
All right, Jill McGivering, thanks so much. Asia editor for our partner, The New York Times. Marcus Mabry, before we go, will Barack Obama debate Ahmadinejad of Iran? There was an offer today.
I think not.
Oh, man, that would be entertainment. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran versus Barack Obama in a debate, nationally televised, globally televised. Not going to happen. All right, we'll leave the agenda there. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for a partner of The New York Times. That's the agenda. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with a question. How do you measure a year?
525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year? In daylights, in sunsets, in midnights, in cups of coffee.
The economy continues to face numerous difficulties.
This is about the U.S. capital markets, the U.S. economy.
A softening labor market, declining house prices.
Measuring a year of some of the worst economic headlines in history. For some, it's been counting the minutes, tough numbers from all sectors of the economy. It's been basically a year since we slipped from the murky waters of regular old economic slowdown to a full-fledged economic meltdown. We can recall the feeling of the shark in those waters. Remember the swimmers? Here they are.
GM and Chrysler.
Lehman Brothers.
WaMu.
Bank of America.
Merrill Lynch.
Wells Fargo.
Citibank.
The bailouts and failures that littered the beaches in this financial crisis are too numerous to name, and they're still continuing. But the huge event of this whole financial mess, recession, what have you, happened on this day last year. The takeover of mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
They are crucial to the mortgage lending industry.
These companies are so big and so interwoven into the financial markets.
I thought it was contained.
I think they have almost $6 trillion in mortgages. It is therefore really, really important that they continue to operate.
Fannie and Freddie, we hardly knew them and their multi-trillion dollar bombshells. Now we own them completely. The beginning of a buying spree that got U.S. taxpayers on the hook for eventually insurance companies, auto companies, more banks. The government even ponied up to buy old clunker cars. Bailout became a dirty word to a lot of our listeners.
I think this is probably the biggest scam in human history.
Sometimes it's necessary to bail out big companies to ensure the trickle-down doesn't affect the smaller Americans.
It's amazing to me, ironically amazing, how they always say the taxpayers bailing something out, but who bails out the taxpayers?
Good question. There were indicators everywhere. I remember at a certain point late last fall, I began to see cars driving around my neighborhood on their spares, lots of them. I called around. Tire repair shops said people were just getting their spares installed, not repairing their tires. They couldn't afford it. In the past year, the U.S. economy shed well over 4 million jobs, more than 6.5 million if you count the entire downturn. Bailouts will help certain companies keep lending and operating, but hiring, that's going to take a while. And some economists suspect that 45% of the layoffs in this recession are permanent. What have we learned, aside from a lot of perverse acronyms and what it is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do, what AIG is, and financial expletives like derivatives and credit default swaps?
An open and transparent market for these transactions would reduce confusion and improve understanding, as well as help with valuation issues.
Valuation issues. Look at your ATM balance to see what that means. Maybe the lesson of the past year is how powerless we all are. Even a Treasury secretary, in the end, does not laugh all the way to the bank bailout.
These companies are so big and so interwoven into the financial markets and our financial system, we had no choice.
525,600 minutes. The steps we've taken to bring our economy back from the brink are working.
That's what the president says. How do you feel? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's been quite a year.
In inches, in miles, in laughter, in strife, in 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year in the life?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we're going to talk, as we do every Monday, on some family issues related to poor parents of public schools are being asked to shell out hundreds of dollars for their kids' education to keep the school's programs operating. More on what that means in just a moment. Also, at the unofficial end of summer, Labor Day weekend, there's probably still a lot on your plate that you wanted to get done. We know Obama has something, getting health care reform passed. But what did you miss out on doing this summer? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakethetakeaway.org. But Femi Okeh has some of the headlines we're following this morning.
Thank you, John. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is expected to appoint a senior counselor for manufacturing policy today. The announcement should take place at a picnic for union workers in Cincinnati. Auto Task Force member Ron Bloom is expected to get the spot. More than half of a deadly wildfire near Los Angeles has been contained. The blaze could still harm thousands of other homes in the region, although none are in immediate danger. Full containment isn't expected until next week. In Northern California, transit workers are scrambling to repair a crack in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. They discovered it over a weekend while they were replacing another part of the bridge. In international news, Venezuela has agreed to send around 20,000 barrels of gasoline a day. Now, this was a story that perplexed John. The move could be to get around some potential trade sanctions from the West due to Iran's nuclear program. So Iran has huge oil reserves, as John remarked earlier this morning, but it actually lacks the ability to make gas-ready fuel, which it has to import. So Venezuela will start shipping gas to Iran in October. There you go.
Thank you.
News you can use, John.
Thank you for solving the mystery, Femi.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
So on Mondays, we try to get a conversation going on all kinds of family issues. And getting back to school is certainly an issue on the table in a lot of families this time of year. While private school parents may be used to getting their tuition bills, parents of some public school students are not getting bills exactly, but they've received letters from money-strapped schools asking for parents to go beyond the usual expenses like books and school supplies, actually asking for, in some cases, hundreds of dollars in cash to help keep school programs running. We're joined by Jody Becker, who's a mom and a journalist in Irvine, California. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning, John.
So, Jody, you got one of these letters, right?
We got a letter, and it's actually attached to a worksheet. So there are some programs that are itemized, and I think the school's really sort of asking you to make a decision. There's a pitch, of course. If you think these programs at our Blue Ribbon School are important, we need your help to keep them going. And then you sort of are implored to work your way through the worksheet and make contributions. And what they were looking for was really about
$300.
But that was on top of the letter that you got before school started saying, please show up at the classroom door with these 27 supplies that we need
right.
to.
Now, of course, all parents want to help their kids in school, but this feels a little like going for the jugular, Jody. Did you have that feeling?
Well, you know, I think the real question is, the perception of need. The school that my daughter goes to is a very well-resourced public school, but the teachers there actually feel like they need this money or they need these things. And I guess that's where I sort of held the letter in my hand and thought, this just does not make sense to me. Mm. I live near some school districts where kids are really struggling. Teachers are really struggling. And it just seems so odd to me that the perception is we really are in crisis in these other schools that have so many resources.
Well, Jody Becker, mom and journalist based in Irvine, California, we should say California is having all kinds of fiscal problems with its deficit and has had to cut educational programs of all kinds. But Lisa Belkin, who also joins us for these segments, writes the parenting blog Motherload for the New York Times. Lisa, how widespread are these pitches from public schools to parents?
They're all over the country. I don't know that there's a school district that hasn't cut something given the economy. And a lot of what goes are the extras or what they can define reasonably as extras. So a lot of cuts in school supplies, huge cuts in some districts, 50% of school supplies in some districts. So the letters go out saying everything from bring, you know, the following six supplies that normally the school would provide,
case.
Or 27 in Jody's case. Or parents getting together saying, wait a second, the classrooms are going to lose their aides. We need to fund that. And in some places, that it's a collection plate to keep a job in the school. So it's across the board. But I would venture to say it's probably everywhere.
Well, I want to get some more details on Jody's story in just a second. But Lisa, it seems to me, just listening to Jody there and listening to you, that parents who are probably accustomed to getting we want parental involvement kind of pitches from public schools are being told, you know, thank you for volunteering, but we actually just need your cash. The volunteer work that you do is maybe not as valuable as the cold hard cash here. Is that the trade-off you're hearing?
I think that probably varies from district to district. I think they want your time, too. I think they want everything, and they're feeling desperate. And Jody will tell you in a minute what she's done, which is unusual. Most people stop at, I can't believe they're asking me for more money. I don't have more money. Or where are my taxes going? Most people stop at that. Jody went a step further and decided how to allocate both her time and her money. But
well, Jody, you made it. Let's get the details there. You made a decision on your sweat equity value and actually have decided to help the school district out, but maybe not in the way that they'd expect it.
Well, that's true. And one kind of funny note on all of this is that I see for the teachers at my daughter's school that managing the volunteer mommies becomes an added job for them. There are so many moms who want to be in the classroom that they have to work out this whole schedule and literally manage sort of people bumping into each other trying to quote unquote help. So I've seen that because I did volunteer last year and my daughter would like me to do it again. What I decided was, well, I know that less than 5 miles from my house, there are classrooms where most of the moms work, can't come into the classroom. All of the students are English language learners. I thought, you know what? I would actually really be helping there, and that's what I would rather do. So I told my daughter, I will work out a schedule where I can be in her classroom every other week, and I will go to another school every other week.
Well, Lisa Belkin, what is the predicament for people who aren't in Jody's situation, who maybe don't have the time to volunteer, who maybe are too strapped for cash and are still getting these pitches? I mean, can they just sort of have to live with their guilt over not being able to help their school and hoping that nothing happens to their child?
There's guilt. There's the feeling that your child just won't have what the other kids have. And then there's the time element. So money is one. And Jody alluded to the really interesting question of time, which is you send your child to school nowadays and then you go with them. And there are all these things that parents are now expected to show up for, you know, reading to kindergartners, the publishing room for first and second graders, going on class trips. And I felt, particularly when my kids were in the younger grades, that I was living in the school. And so it is a time or money. Schools are asking for both, and you get to feel guilty on both ends now. Before, you just felt guilty if you weren't there. Now you're guilty if you're not there with your checkbook.
Well, speaking of guilt, Jody Becker, I mean, do they keep track of the number of parents who've actually contributed? I mean, is this public knowledge? I mean, is the principal going to publish who's the deadbeat in the fourth grade there in Irvine?
You know, it's very interesting because your producer asked me if I had sent the money, and I said, oh, you know, we're going to send it. I just spaced out. I haven't sent it in yet. But it did occur to me, gosh, I wonder sort of where this data is compiled and who knows. And as I mentioned in the little post I wrote for Lisa's blog, you know, one of the questions is, my child will enjoy all of the perks of her very nice school, and I don't want my child to be a free rider. Of course, we're going to contribute, but I really feel Lisa's talking about the issue that is almost as important, if not more important, which is time. And the presence of a caring adult in a classroom other than the teacher, to me, seems so much more precious in a classroom where the parents don't have the free time to do that.
Well, it's a trade-off, time versus money, and parents are experiencing it as public schools ask for real money. Jody Becker, mom and journalist from Irvine, California. We're also joined by our contributor, Lisa Belkin, who writes the parenting blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks to both of you on this Labor Day. And so, the holiday weekend doesn't just mean that school's starting. It's also summer's unofficial end. There's probably still a lot on your plate you wanted to get done. We know Obama has one big something on his to-do list, passing health care reform.
As late as Saturday, he still didn't know what he wanted to say about health care. And this late in the process, for him to not know what he wanted to say about health care, that's a very bad sign.
To take away from Washington Examiner's Julie Mason, so what did you miss out on doing this summer? Leo Duran going to the water park and getting pruny fingers, he says. Stephanie Hughes, I regret not sleeping more. That's a sad regret. Matt Lieber, breaking 90 on the golf course. Too bad, Matt. Maybe next year. Shubha Bala, going hiking upstate, visiting my nephew, training for the half marathon. Call us your regrets at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And, of course, you can weigh in on anything you hear today, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway. Summer 2009, put it in the books.
Summer has come and passed. The innocent can never last.
He was going to get in the way of the president and ultimately this country moving forward on something as important as creating jobs in a clean energy economy.
No, TV puppet head Glenn Beck isn't getting in the way of the president moving forward. It's a White House green jobs staffer named Van Jones. Glenn Beck bags his first victim, and the administration stands aside.
This cannot be the same country I grew up in. In my day, more people on television would be telling you the truth.
Wake me up when September ends.
Oh, that's a long way off. Meanwhile, truth beckons on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, September 7th. Happy Labor Day. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up, the text of President Obama's speech on education to young kids is out today. We're going to talk about the controversy surrounding talking to school children. We'll also talk with school officials from around the country about what they're doing concretely to prepare for H1N1 virus, the swine flu. But first, let's check back in with Julie Mason, White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. So, Julie, this Van Jones story that was ginned up by Glenn Beck on the Fox Network, I mean, is this a one-day story, his resignation, or does this go through the week?
Sadly, no, John. They're going to try to get as much as they can at Fox News onto this Van Jones story. And I have to ask, Van who? No one's even heard of the guy, but they're going to get as much mileage and high dudgeon as they can onto this.
Remember when it was Glenn who? Those were the days, Julie. Stay with us. Julie Mason from The Washington Examiner. But first, the headlines. In the headlines, everything else you need to know. A Swedish charity is accusing American troops of storming through a hospital in central Afghanistan. Aid workers say that soldiers broke down doors and tied up hospital staff in a search for militants. The Pentagon says it's investigating the incident. Meanwhile, our partner, The New York Times, reports that Afghans loyal to President Hamid Karzai made up hundreds of fake polling sites for the presidential election last month. Election workers say no one voted at these sites, but hundreds of thousands of ballots were still counted. A Sudanese woman found guilty of indecency for wearing pants in public. She's a journalist and fined $200. It's not known why she wasn't sentenced to a public whipping, which is the usual penalty for such an offense in Sudan. And here in the U.S., more than 50% of the wildfire near Los Angeles has been contained. Thousands of homes in the region are still in harm's way, and full containment of the so-called station fire isn't expected until next week. In Northern California, transit workers are working fast to repair a crack in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. They discovered it over the weekend while they were replacing another part of the bridge and investigating an earthquake upgrade. And in economic news, the British company Cadbury has rejected a $16.7 billion merger offer from Kraft Foods. Cadbury says the proposal undervalued them. Wall Street has the day off for the holidays, but in Europe, all major indices are up more than 1%. And on this unofficial end of summer weekend, there's probably some stuff on your plate you wanted to get done. Maybe get in the water. Maybe, go on a boat ride, a road trip. We know Obama wanted to pass health care reform. What did you miss out on doing this summer? You still have some time to do it. Call us and tell us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. So depending on what poll numbers you look at, it's been a difficult summer for President Obama. We talked about his to-do list. He's not done everything he would want to have done this summer. But when he addresses health care in a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, it's going to be an uphill battle. He'll be on the defensive. He's going to have to get specific. But we're going to take a look at two other stories that are generating controversy in ways that might be a little surprising. First, the president has a planned address to school children tomorrow, or all kinds of controversy in the media and elsewhere about this speech to kids. We're going to talk to someone who's actually dealing firsthand with that at a school. But first, we go to Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, to talk about the other story that blew up this weekend, the resignation of President Obama's so-called green energy czar, Van Jones. Julie, we had him on the show twice before he was named, and then once afterward. I have to say, he's not my idea of a threatening guy, but I also don't want to take a position on what he was doing in the White House. I'm just wondering, did this surprise you at all?
It did surprise me, the capitulation by the White House. No one stood up to defend Van Jones, or nobody dug in their heels and said, "We're not gonna capitulate to Glenn Beck. This is our guy."
Well, maybe there's more to the story, and we don't know. But let's try to give people the details as best as we know them. A couple of weeks ago, Glenn Beck appeared on the Fox program Fox and Friends and had this controversial remark to make about President Obama.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture. I don't know what it is.
Well, that ricocheted around the blogosphere, and in reaction to Glenn Beck's comments, the Fox commentator, an organization called Color of Change asked advertisers to boycott Beck's show, and they apparently had some impact. And Van Jones, the green energy czar in the Obama White House, is the co-founder of Color of Change. And instead of defending his own comments, Glenn Beck went right after Van Jones. And listen to him talking about Glenn as recently as August 24th.
A major turning point came in 1993 when he was arrested during the Rodney King riots. In jail, he, quote, met all of these young radical people of color. I mean, really radical, communists and anarchists. And it was like, this is what I need to be a part of, end quote.
A biography, according to Glenn Beck, of Van Jones, who finally resigned on Saturday, saying, according to a statement that Robert Gibbs, White House press secretary, quoted, that he would be in the way of helping the White House's agenda on green jobs. Julie Mason, is it Glenn Beck 1, the Obama administration 0?
Yeah, I have to say that that's certainly the score as it stands.
Why does an administration get itself involved in a very defensive, really kind of fringy sort of effort to enhance their ratings and programming at the expense of, you know, a smart, intelligent guy? And we're going to play some tape of Van Jones talking on this program. But why would the administration even come close to this?
Well, this is their pattern, John, and the same thing with the talking to the school kids. They capitulate. They don't want any trouble. They don't want these distractions. They're focused on health care and the other things that Obama wants to get done, and they know how destructive these kinds of distractions can be to the larger agenda, so they don't want to deal with it. They're just going to cut it off. No one stepped up to defend Van Jones, so he had to fall on his sword and go.
Is it possible there's more to this story that we don't know about?
There's always more to the story.
And do you haven't heard anything?
No.
All right. Well, you know, Van Jones, he was on this program talking about green jobs and green energy. I mean, I could not imagine a less offensive and less threatening individual. I guess this only encourages people like Glenn Beck to try to bring somebody else down. Yes or no, Julie Mason?
Yes, definitely. I think Glenn Beck is feeling his oats now. I think he feels pretty tough. The risk for him is overreaching. Who's he going to go after next? You know, and what's going to happen? I mean, Van Jones did have this truther background that was a little questionable, and that's a big red flag for, you know, Fox News and Fox News viewers.
All right. Well, he's certainly going to dominate the programming today, if not tomorrow and the end of the week. Julie Mason, thanks so much for joining us. Julie Mason,
of course,
White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a regular here on The Takeaway, just like Van Jones was. Here's him speaking on this program in July of this year.
I'm excited to be a part of an administration like President Obama's administration that has put jobs front and center and the idea of economic opportunity for all Americans. And at the same time, the way you have the jobs of tomorrow is that you make the products of tomorrow. The products of tomorrow are advanced automobiles, advanced energy, renewable energy, wind turbines, solar panels.
Well, Van Jones is a Obama official of yesterday. He resigned on Saturday. So tomorrow at a Virginia high school, the president will deliver back-to-back school speeches aimed at children. He's expected to talk about the value of hard work and the need to stay in school. After Secretary of Education Arne Duncan sent a letter to principals encouraging them to show the speech in schools, critics of the president accused him of trying to indoctrinate children with socialist ideas. Again, the issue ricocheted around the blogosphere and talk radio and talk television. Joining us now is Sherry Fowler, a spokeswoman for the Rockwell Independent School District, kindergarten through 12th grade, and she joins us from her home in Rockwall, Texas. Sherry, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And happy Labor Day. How did you hear about this speech the president was going to give? And then how did you react to the controversy in the media that began to erupt once people reacted to it?
Well, we became acutely aware of the speech this past Wednesday, and it apparently hit some conservative talk shows. And we have a number of listeners in our area, and our constituency is mainly Republican in the Rockwall area these days. And so we began getting phone calls immediately on Wednesday with parents really just wanting to know our district policy and voicing their concerns regarding a number of things. I've probably fielded over 50 personal phone calls or emails regarding the situation in the last couple of days.
Now, did any of that surprise you? And I would think on the face of it, the president making contact with students, I mean, yes, we have politics in America, but in general, that would be a civics lesson for kids that most educators would respond enthusiastically to, right? Or am I nuts here?
No, you're not nuts. Absolutely. I'm the mother of two children also in the school district. So on face value, it doesn't seem threatening in any way, particularly since the Department of Education posted what they felt the content would be, do good in school. And I'm all for that if that can encourage my kids. But as I listened to a number of parents, what became clear was that parents very much wanted parental choice in this situation. They wanted to be able to have prior review, perhaps, and definitely wanted the choice of whether their child should hear that or not. And they were not comfortable with the school district just putting it in every single classroom for every child.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, do parents have the same issue with maybe a speech of FDR's during the New Deal, any sort of history discussion that would involve presidential speeches? Is it an apples and oranges kind of thing?
I think there's a couple of issues here. One is that this is the first time that we've ever had the technology available that really could broadcast it widely throughout the school system. In our school system, even a few years back, it would have been you type a speech and maybe show it, you know, in a TV later or something. So the ability to broadcast something live time without prior review is something very new for us in particular. So that was one thing parents were responding to. Another thing is that, you know, you ask about curriculum applications. Not having reviewed it prior to it, showing parents were concerned at what those curriculum applications would be, particularly the items that were provided by the Department of Education. Some had concerns over that and issues with those items, and they expressed that to me. We have said all along that if President Obama's speech is, you know, very much what he says, then it's a great example for a government class or a history class or a speech class to use in their curriculum at a later time. We've just chosen at this time to make it an optional viewing and let the parents make that choice for their children.
Now, if President Obama offered to come down to your school district and speak, would you immediately gather together a committee of concerned parents and tell him no if they voted it down?
No, absolutely not. In fact, we recently had our all-district meeting at the beginning of school where all our 2,000 employees get together, and our superintendent actually chose to play a video where President Obama was prominently featured talking about volunteering in your community. So President Obama has already been held up in our school district as a role model on another topic, volunteering. So it's not an issue of President Obama or not. This is really an issue of parental choice in this situation.
Well, spokeswoman for the Rockwell Independent School District down there in Rockwell, Texas, Sherry Fowler, thanks so much for joining us. It's a kindergarten through 12th grade district dealing with the issue of President Obama speaking. The text of the speech will be released later today. Raj is following our coverage on the resignation of Van Jones we were talking about a moment ago. Obama's green job czar, he questioned me, saying it's simply a silly media dust-up. He emails, I, a lifelong Democrat, feel that the hiring of Jones was an egregious example of the lack of background vetting. What do you think? Weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or myticket@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll talk with someone who's reimagining how your kids are taught on The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. At this point in George W. Bush's first term, the educational reform program No Child Left Behind was already passed. The buzzword for educational reform then was accountability. In the Obama administration, accountability is still a theme for improving educational performance, but Obama's Secretary of Education wants to go beyond what he calls tinkering around the edges and seems to be willing to commit $3.5 billion to what he calls radical new ideas. So on this Labor Day back-to-school weekend, we think the voice of educational reform, Obama-style, just might be my next guest. Steve Barr, he's the founder of California-based Green Dot Public Schools. Steve Barr, thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you?
So let's talk a little bit about your tactics working in Southern California in the L.A. area. You have a charter school company that basically is working with public schools, and you're known for some very, very fast-acting, almost SWAT team kinds of tactics. Tell me about Locke High School in Southern California.
Well, Locke High School is was opened after the Watts riots in the mid-60s as an answer, and was supposed to bring hope to the Watts community. What ended up happening is it became a place where other schools dumped their kids they didn't want, and teachers that wanted to go play out contracts and hide went. So in 40 years, which is right about the time we formed a partnership with the existing teachers there to take the school and enact No Child Left Behind, in those 40 years, 60,000 people went to that school, give or take 1,000, and we think 40,000 of them didn't make it out of that school. So you imagine, you know, and then out of those 20,000 that were left, maybe a little over 2,000 actually got college degrees. So if only 2,000 people out of 60,000 people are getting college degrees and not coming back to that community because there's not a lot to offer, boy, you really are talking about a community that has got no hope. Now, the problem with that is there's a lot of Locke High Schools, not only in Los Angeles, but nationally. There's thousands of them.
Well, let's talk specifically about what you did at Locke, because I think the real question for you and for Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education, is whether your tactics are scalable to more of a national program. How do you go from a school that has such a terrible record, as you described, and actually do what some have called a hostile takeover to turn it into a series of charter schools and essentially replace the workforce?
Well, I mean, you know, when something just fails over and over again, it has repercussions beyond that community. And so I don't think there's anything controversial or hostile about it. I think it's hostile to ignore it. So what we did is actually the teachers contacted us, fed up with the lack of support from the district and their union. We had hired teachers from Locke in the past. They obviously were talking about having improvement in work conditions and how, you know, good we teach teachers and also how focused we are. And more than half the teachers signed up a petition to liberate the school. So what we did is we looked at the school. We wanted to create more of a collegiate feel to it. We're college preparatories is our kind of our vision for the world. We think high expectations for all kids works. And we broke the school down into 7 small autonomous schools and then also took the 10, 11, 12th graders in. And what we do is those kids have separate entrances, separate lunches, and separate curriculum, but you have a small school feel in each one of those schools. Every adult gets to know every kid in a small school setting and what's unique about them. And then also, they're the ones that have to undo the 8 years of neglect that we inherit. Those kids are just pushed through the system. So we get half those kids who come in somewhere between the first and third grade reading level, and even in Locke's case, even less on reading scores. We've got to turn them around in that year. And so what happened this year at Locke was traditionally that school goes from about 1,200 freshmen to about 500 sophomore. That means 700 kids leave that school before they're 15 into one of the worst gang territories. We held all across the school over 80% of the kids.
So that's your retention rate, 80%.
Yeah, which is, you know, if you look at a Tony suburban school, that matches that. So if you don't do that baseline, you have no chance of turning the school around. We made the school safe. We pushed the gangs off the campus who used to own the campus to one block off. We found out, like we have in most neighborhoods that we serve, gang members don't want their kids to be gang members, so they want the schools to work.
That's interesting. Well, Steve, let's talk. So your first metric is retention rate. You have to move on to test scores, and this is really a long game. Do you have the patience for staying in this for like 8, 10, 12 years to really move an entire generation through a school system and improve things for all time?
Oh, yeah, definitely the patience. You have to have the patience because it not only brings hope to that neighborhood, but to the rest of the city. You know, I live in Silver Lake, which is an upper middle class neighborhood outside of downtown Los Angeles. My neighbors now see hope. Boy, if you can do that at Locke, why aren't we putting demand and political pressure on Marshall High School in my neighborhood? So I think it's the political tipping point because unlike charters where you can kind of explain away results sometimes and debate back and forth whether they're effective, you take the biggest dropout factory in that city, as one politician called it, a tax-subsidized gang recruitment center, not a school, and you make it a preparatory, and you actually have the results that we know we're getting and going to have in the future, that should send hope.
So you literally want to get rid of this program of charter schools tinkering around the edges and cherry-picking the best students and go directly at the center of the sort of crater of underserved kids, turn that around, and let the charter school stuff sort of follow along.
Well, I don't get rid of charter schools. I mean, I'm a charter school operator. That's where the R&D has got to come. But I just, you know, and I respect people who build one charter school in a neighborhood just to serve that community. I respect people. I mean, our mission is systemic change. And, you know, I want my 4-year-old and my 1-year-old to go to a great California public school like I went to 30 years ago when we led the nation in education, not a charter school. They will go to a charter school if I have to build one for them, but I'd rather have systemic change. I'd rather most of LAUSD to look like Green Dot schools.
One involved parent, that's for sure. Finally, how do you know the Obama administration is listening to you, Steve Barr?
Well, I think they're listening to a lot of people, but I haven't been this inspired about politics for a long time. I mean, I worked in a campaign for Clinton, but I don't think I ever for one second thought about moving across country to help to move to D.C. But I went and knocked on doors for this guy in Des Moines, and I don't feel like it's right for me to sit and go, God, I hope it works out for him the next 4 years. I feel like I have to do something. And so we're launching something or looking to launch something called Green Dot America, which will be a turnaround organization to hopefully become a template for other people, which includes not only the turnaround and what we've learned from Locke, but organizing parents and including them in the fight, but also partnering with teachers' unions, which is a unique aspect of Green Dot.
Well, that takes it beyond the tinkering around the edges and moves it into the radical realm that Arne Duncan is talking about. Steve Barr, thanks so much. Good luck with Green Dot America. He's the founder of the California-based Green Dot Public School Program. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it.
And we're still hearing from you about our coverage on Van Jones. He resigned on Saturday. Jeff emails us, whatever the merits of the current controversy, he is, as demonstrated on several interviews over the last year or so, an innovative, deeply versed thinker on the connection between environment and society. He was Barack Obama's green job czar. He resigned on Saturday. What's your take? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now let's check in with Femi Okay for the stories that we're following.
President Obama heads to Cincinnati today, where he'll address union members at their Labor Day picnic. He's expected to announce that Ron Blum will be his new advisor on manufacturing. Overseas, Israel's government has approved construction on hundreds of new apartments in the West Bank. It's the first move of its kind since Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took office. The decision comes despite strong disagreement between the US and Israel over expansion into settlements. And in financial news, Kraft Foods says that it will pursue a deal with the British confectioner Cadbury. Cadbury rejected an initial offer of nearly $17 billion, saying that it undervalued the company. And that's a look at your news for now.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
H1N1 swine flu infection. For intervention, I bring prevention. Dr. Carl,
because viruses go everywhere, everybody's getting into the act on H1N1 swine flu prevention as the school season begins. Even Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, addressed the issue, although he didn't rap on yesterday's Face the Nation program.
Continuity of learning is so important. As you know, we have so many working families. When schools close, it creates tremendous social disruption. So if you reach a horrible critical mass where you have to, we'll do that. We're really trying to say if you're sick, stay home. Stay home until 24 hours after the fever breaks. That's when you become less contagious. But schools are really trying to stay open. So far, they're doing a great job.
There are a number of federal agencies that have a stake in the H1N1 flu virus this fall, besides the CDC and the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, Health and Human Services. There's the Department of Education, and Arne Duncan is there speaking on what schools need to do. We want to start a conversation that will give you more information as the school season begins this week. Dr. William Schaffner joins us. He's of the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Vanderbilt School of Medicine, where he is chair, joins us from Nashville. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Lisa Swank is Public Health Emergency Preparedness Coordinator with the Harford County Health Department, also a registered nurse, who's speaking with us from Bel Air, Maryland. Lisa Swank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Carol Johnson is the superintendent for Boston's public schools on the line from Boston. Carol, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Quickly for the three of you, and then I want to go into more detail. Do you think, and I'll start with you, Dr. Schaffner, that the response toolkit is coming into focus for H1N1 at this stage?
Oh, yes. I think that Arne Duncan and others, even the president, have told us what to do. And you just heard Arne Duncan talk about some of those things. Excuse me, hand hygiene. If your child is sick, don't send them to school. Parents ought to think in advance about child care issues. And lots of schools are providing hand hygiene gels and emphasis on hand washing right in the classroom. So lots of good things happening.
All right, Lisa Swank, how about you? The toolkit is clear. The response is absolutely straightforward for parents who are going to have questions this week.
I think one of the most important messages, too, is to emphasize the seasonal flu vaccine for children as well. We, of course, are waiting for the H1N1 vaccine approval and hope to have that. But the most important thing we feel like right now is to make sure that all those children are vaccinated against seasonal as well.
Right. And the seasonal vaccine is available, but the H1N1 vaccine probably won't be available till sometime in October. Carol Johnson, colleges that have opened already are already seeing outbreaks in specific dorms, in specific areas of campus. Some have done quarantine and isolation as a response. What lessons are you seeing from some of these headlines out of Atlanta and other places? Carol Johnson, superintendent for Boston's public schools.
Well, John, we've had an H1N1 planning committee that's been meeting weekly all summer long, and it really is a joint partnership between the public health department here. We've had a positive and longstanding relationship with Dr. Barbara Ferreira in that department, and Mayor Menino here in Boston convened a planning summit on August 21st, where we invited people from higher ed institutions, public health, private providers, educators, early childhood people, so that we could be well planned. And I think we've aligned our messages and our work with the toolkit, with the CDC guidelines, and I think we feel very well prepared to communicate to families and to work with our staff to do as much as we can to limit the spread.
Now, what if happens like what happened last week down at Emory University in Atlanta? You get suddenly 50 people at a particular school with all the symptoms, and they're right in the target age group where people say the symptoms could be really severe. What do you do next?
Well, of course, last spring, the guidance was to close schools, and we did close 15 schools. This year, the guidance is really trying to limit commingling of students from different classrooms and, in some cases, having to cancel large gatherings of social events. I think what we're trying to do is encourage, first of all, parents to keep their children at home, staff to stay at home when they have symptoms, and trying to limit the need to completely close schools. We certainly will have homework packets and information so that students who do stay home still have to do some more homework feel better.
I see. So you got that all worked out. Well, you've thought this through well. I guess getting out of homework is not going to be an H1N1 option. Dr. Schaffner, if you're healthy, the message is get the hand washing and the sanitary techniques up to speed in your family and at school. What if you're starting to feel symptoms? How long should you stay home, Dr. Schaffner?
Well, you should stay home for 24 hours after your symptoms have resolved. And for people particularly with underlying illnesses, once the symptoms start, immediately call. You don't visit, but call your doctor, because your doctor may want to prescribe an antiviral medication for you, which will shorten the course of the illness.
Don't visit, because that's where all the vectors are. That's where all the sick people are going to be. Lisa Swank, if there's a clamoring for Tamiflu antiviral drug to deal with people with symptoms, are you going to even be able to have close to enough in that situation?
The CDC is providing us information currently with how to distribute additional supplies. We're looking at triggers right now as to when that would be available, and we're also working closely with our community partners that are providing that antiviral in the private sector right now. So I think that there will be enough. It's just a matter of coordinating that effort.
Right. If this was CNN, I guess I'd ask you all, what's your worst-case scenario? But I'm going to forget that. I'm going to actually ask, what if this blows over and is no big deal? How do you prevent this from being a cry wolf message so that the next time nobody pays attention? Dr. Schaffner, you first, and then I want to get a quick response from Lisa and Carol.
Well, it is a big deal. It's starting to be a big deal already, and it's going to take over. I always think being prepared against a worse outcome is preferable to being caught like Katrina and not having done enough.
Well said. Dr. William Schaffner is the chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Vanderbilt School of Medicine. He spoke with us from Nashville, Tennessee. Lisa Swank, how do you prevent a cry wolf message?
I think the most important thing with this event, no matter what happens, is it certainly sharpens our ability to work with our community partners in terms of the public health and the community working together. And you can't lose when you're working together with any kind of event.
So you're working those public health muscles in this H1N1 crisis. That's a great takeaway. Lisa Swank is Public Health Emergency Preparedness Coordinator with the Hartford County Health Department in Bel Air, Maryland. Thanks to her. Carol Johnson, take us out up there at the Boston Public Schools where you're superintendent.
Well, I agree with Lisa that these partnerships are critically important at any time. And so having these conversations early on it would be really an important thing. Also, having our nurses prepared with scanners, with masks, making sure our custodians are stocked with soap and paper towels, all these are really good, healthy things to do no matter what. And so I think that if we're able to prevent the spread, if we don't see the massive spread it will probably be due to the significant amount of preparation that we've done.
Well, Carol Johnson, superintendent for Boston's Public Schools, thanks so much. Great conversation. I think while Femi does the headlines, I'm going to wash my hands.
President Obama speaks to union workers at a Labor Day picnic in Cincinnati today. Astronauts are loading up the space shuttle Discovery for their return home from the International Space Station tomorrow. Venezuela will ship 20,000 barrels of gasoline a day to Iran. That starts in October. And at the box office, the sci-fi horror movie The Final Destination took the top spot for the second weekend in a row.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a warm welcome to Sotheby's and this historic sale. Damien Hirst.
Damien Hirst. What's your taste for preserved sharks, etc.? How's this for irony? On the very day that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, the investment bank, the art market hit a peak. $200 million was raised in one day for Damien Hirst's artwork, and that was for a diamond-encrusted skull. What a difference a year makes. If Lehman Brothers had actually sold their art collection at that moment, the day they filed for bankruptcy, maybe they'd still be in business, but didn't happen that way. Mired in controversy and legal wrangling over the last year, the art collection now is going under the hammer. The BBC's Lawrence Pollard has been investigating what's going to happen to the Lehman Brothers art collection. He joins us from Bush House in London. Good morning, Lawrence.
Hi there, John.
So Lehman Brothers, investment bankers, they don't really go in for the Damien Hirst diamond-encrusted skulls and preserved sharks kind of thing, right? It's a different art collection altogether.
Well, what's interesting is it's this corporate art collection. I mean, Lehman's, love and marriage, they go together, as we know, like a horse and carriage, and so does art and money. You know, if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there is a whole wing called the Robert Lehman Collection.
That's right.
It's a fantastic collection that was left to them in 1969.
Andrew Mellon, the banker, created
exactly,
the National Gallery of Art.
One after another, yeah. You know. And Lehman's had a very, very good corporate art collection, and you nicely illustrated the incredible irony, kind of like the absolute top of the market, this Damien Hirst selling his stuff direct to the collectors. This happened on the day that Lehman's was collapsing. So you kind of think the maximum confidence in the art market just at the moment when that crucial thing is disappearing. Lehman's is allowed to go bankrupt, files for bankruptcy, confidence just crashes. Now, what Lehman's had, apart from corporate jets, a condo in Miami, yellow cake, uranium, all these other things that they had, which the liquidators are now getting rid of course they had a fantastic corporate art collection. And I was just interested with the irony of this kind of like what was happening a year ago, sort of what actually happened to this stuff. And of course, you remember all those pictures of Lehman's guys and girls walking out with all their goods in a cardboard box.
Those were photographs. Those weren't art pictures.
Exactly.
Not performance art. No.
They should have taken something off the wall.
Right.
Because there is a really, really good collection, which is going on sale, it now turns out, after the liquidators got an art consultant to come in and tell them what they should do. Now, of course, as you know, the big problem is that when you come to sell your assets after a bankruptcy,
you're flooding the market.
Hey, the assets aren't worth anything. Right. So what's interesting is, although there are millions of dollars worth of art which are being sold by Freeman's in Philadelphia, it's actually the 1st of November is the first of three sales, there's other stuff as well which is being held back, and no one will tell us what it is. So if I could make an appeal for anyone who is a director of Lehman's and is listening to your program and wants to tell us what they had in the boardroom, please let us know. Because there must be stuff which is being held back, and the tactics of this is quite interesting. I mean, I am speculating here, I have to say. But if you think they have fantastic stuff that they're holding back, they don't want creditors to come knocking on their door saying, hey, you've got to, let's say for the sake of argument, a Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol or whatever, you've got to put that on the market now. They don't want to put it on the market now.
Is it
because
all...
it's not going to fetch enough, you see.
What we do know, is it like landscapes and conservative stuff? Or
Basically the conservative stuff and also prints. They had a fantastic collection of prints because what Lehman's did, which was amazing, was they went to working artists like Louise Bourgeois and said, give us your latest stuff.
Like commissioned
stuff. Yeah. So they were getting really, really cutting edge stuff and stuff that was being made by artists. It's a fantastic collection.
But
of course, prints and so on, you know, they're not worth so big. One of the things I have to say that
quickly,
I think is really interesting.
You got 2 seconds.
Yeah, really quickly. Just imagine, you can buy a print of the New York Stock Exchange, which used to belong to Lehman's, which caused the stock exchange to crash. How cool would that be?
Lawrence Pollard, BBC Arts correspondent, talking about the Lehman collection on sale now.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Coming up, we've got a little bit of a combat flashback for you, financially speaking. The economic crisis 1 year later in just a few minutes. Also, on Labor Day, the unofficial end of summer, there's probably something on your plate you wanted to get done. We know Obama has one of those, getting health care reform passed. So what did you miss out on doing this summer?
My name is Andrea, and I didn't finish my book. Now I have to start school, in other words, teaching. So it's all over for the rest of the year until next summer.
Oh, man, I hate it when that happens. 8778-MYTAKE or email your summer regrets at MyTake at thetakeaway.org. First, Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, in Afghanistan, a Swedish charity is accusing American troops of storming through a hospital in central Afghanistan. Aid workers say that soldiers broke down doors and tied up hospital staff in a search for militants. The Pentagon says that it's investigating the incident. Moving to Africa now, have a listen into this angry scene outside a courthouse in Sudan today. That's the sound of women protesting as a female journalist stood trial today for wearing pants in public. She was found guilty of public indecency and was fined $200 but not sentenced to a public whipping, which is the usual penalty. Astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery are packing up to leave the International Space Station for tomorrow. They're coming back with some extra equipment, completed science experiments and lots of trash. And down on Earth in Northern California, transit workers are working fast to repair a crack in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. They discovered it over the weekend while they were replacing another part of that bridge. That's a look at some of the stories we've been following this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Our system basically failed its most fundamental tests. It was too fragile, too vulnerable to shock.
We're going to have to save those banks, save those banks, save those banks. Even if we cashier out the guys who took the big bonuses.
I think the idea of injecting capital directly into banks is a good one.
When they fail, they get a bonus, the taxpayer gets the bill. It isn't right. It just simply isn't right.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. All week long, a look back at the year that was, that marked the beginning of the financial meltdown, which became the recession that we are dealing with, in headlines virtually every day. And joining us to talk about this year, which began with the federal acquisition of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, organizations that we didn't necessarily know that much about before they became government-owned mortgage entities worth $5 trillion or more, and at the center of the housing meltdown, which became everything else that we have experienced in this last year. Joining us now is Gillian Tett, capital markets editor for the Financial Times, author of a great book, Fool's Gold, How the Bold Dream of a Small Tribe at J.P. Morgan Was Corrupted by Wall Street Greed and Unleashed a Catastrophe. She joins us from London. Good morning, Gillian.
Good morning.
Also with us is Joe Nocera, a New York Times business correspondent for our partner. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, John.
And John Hilzenrath is chief economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, whose byline was all over the stories that began a year ago and before. John, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, John, let's begin with you. When did you know this was off in uncharted territory? Was it a year ago? Was it before that?
Well, you know, for us, the story really started in the summer of 2007, I'd have to say, when two Bear Stearns hedge funds started teetering and had to be rescued by Bear Stearns itself. That was really the beginning of this cascade. Things seemed to have settled down in the summer of 2008, and then it blew up with Lehman Brothers. But by the time Lehman Brothers had collapsed, we already had a lot of exhausted reporters who were a year into digging into this story.
Indeed, and Joe Nocera, you were one of them. When do you think the point was that the broad American electorate became aware of financial crises that were going to have clear implications to all Americans and people all over the world?
Well, it did take a while because Main Street doesn't necessarily see the link between its health and Wall Street's health. And so I would say that for a fair amount of time in 2008, when Bear Stearns failed and when the banks were taking these large write-downs but were still had the ability to raise capital, there was mainly a feeling of shame on Main Street. But Lehman Weekend, one of the things that happened that Monday after Lehman defaulted was that the stock market went down 500 or 600 points.
Yeah.
And it was suddenly there was fear in the air, and that fear was really quite palpable. And I would say that was the weekend when Main Street said, we've got a problem too.
Yeah, those kind of numbers.
And it went beyond just the stock market because, I mean, one of the real scary moments that Monday was when
there was a money market fund named the Reserve Fund, which broke the buck. And people started thinking not only that their stock market investments were going away, but that their really safe cash investments disappear too.
Right, which caused the prospect of a run on the banks and something much, much wider. Gillian Tett, you know, there are so many scenes in your book, Fool's Gold, that describe the really very, very beginnings of all this. And it goes way back before a year ago. What do you think the mathematicians and the brainiacs who really started these kind of large-scale derivatives had in mind and missed when they got started in some of the great scenes that you describe in Fool's Gold?
Well, for the most part, they thought they were building a safer financial system. I mean, that is a terrible irony of all this innovation, is that the idea was that by slicing and dicing up credit risks and into newfangled instruments and spreading them all over the world, they thought they'd have a system which would be able to contain the shocks and absorb any blows. And it turned out to be dead wrong, because in fact what has happened in the last 2 years is that the system has become prone to terrible contagion and really an explosion of fear, as people have realized they don't really understand how finance works.
Well, you discovered that when you were trying to get to the bottom of these derivatives markets. And it seems to me that the theme of your book is hiding risk is different from eliminating risk, and that a lot of very senior people on Wall Street and around the world didn't understand that.
That's absolutely right. And going back to, say, the summer of 2007, one of the key reasons why the collapse of the Bear Stearns hedge funds caused so much panic was that people suddenly realized that not only were many of these securities, which are supposed to be ultra safe, not so safe after all, but also it was incredibly hard to understand who was actually exposed to that. And you had the very unpleasant equivalent of, say, a food poisoning scare, where people knew that there were bad assets in the system, subprime mortgages were going wrong, and that really began to be clear in the summer of 2007. But it took a very long time to work out where the buck stopped in terms of who was exposed to it.
Oh, that's a great takeaway. John Hilsenrath, you talked about fear feeding on itself a moment ago. The inability to value things really created a pause in time where fear built, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the problems the Lehman Brothers weekend was that, you know, with formulating a rescue, was that people were very unsure about what Lehman Brothers portfolio was. You know, the Fed has a policy that it can lend against good assets. In the end, they, you know, one of the arguments that they've made since the collapse was that they couldn't lend against Lehman Brothers assets because it turned out that they were worth a lot less than Lehman Brothers were saying they were worth on their books. That was one of many symptoms of this valuation problem.
Right. And, John, the flip side of that, of course, is that they then agreed, they were so scared about AIG, they agreed to lend money to AIG, $85 billion worth, allegedly because it did have collateral,
right,
which, of course, if there's one bucket of money that the government may never get back, it's the money they lent
right
to AIG.
Yeah.
So quickly,
AIG was essential to innovation storm. You know,
right.
They were
essential to the innovations. Right. Exactly.
You know, it also points to something about, you know, we're talking about the innovation and you know how the original idea was that it's supposed to disperse risk. I mean, what happened in the year or two before all of this cascaded upon itself was that a lot of these derivatives were used to multiply risk and
right
not to disperse it. You had credit default swaps, where basically it became a gambling casino for people to make bets on the financial health of financial institutions and other companies.
Well, we've got to go, unfortunately. John Hilsenrath, Jonah Sarah, and Gillian Tett. Have we learned lessons in the past year, Gillian, yes or no?
I think we certainly have heard lessons, but the big question is whether policymakers can actually implement the proper solutions to deal with those lessons.
Jonah Sarah, what do you think?
I agree with Gillian. We still haven't solved too big to fail. We still haven't solved capital requirements. We still haven't solved what to do about the rating agencies.
Oh.
I mean, you know, we got issues.
Getting depressed, Joe. John, take us out.
I agree with both of your other guests. You know, it's amazing that they still don't have a system in place for dealing with a financial institution that's on the brink of collapse.
Amazing. 1 year later, John Hilsenrath, chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We also spoke with Joe Nocera, New York Times business columnist, and Gillian Tett, author of Fool's Gold. She's capital markets editor for the Financial Times, A Year of Financial Meltdown. Hard to believe. We'll be looking back at the financial crisis year one all this week. Tomorrow, the state of housing with Robert Schiller, one of the people behind the closely watched housing numbers. And we're still hearing from you about Van Jones stepping down, Obama's green jobs czar.
President Obama has to learn how to fight back. He's being cowed. He's being bullied. There's nobody that President Obama can pick for any role anywhere that they're not going to find some fault with.
Weigh in on anything on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And because it's Labor Day, it's the unofficial end of summer. Tell us your summer regrets. What didn't you get around to? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great day. It's The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.